Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, I talked to author Lee Rourke about his novel, Vulgar Things, and about Southend, our adopted hometown. Lee Rourke is the author of the short story collection Every Day and the novel The Canal, which won The Guardian's Not the Booker Prize in 2010. He is writer-in-residence at Kingston University, where he is an MFA lecturer in creative writing and critical theory. He also lectures in creative writing at the University of East London. His latest novel is Vulgar Things, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. So, Lee, thank you very much for joining me on Little Atoms.
You're welcome.
Tell us in your own words what Vulgar Things is about, first of all.
It's a kind of strange quest novel. It's a guy who has kind of been spat out of his kind of the treadmill of his life in London onto Canvey because his estranged uncle Ray has sadly committed suicide. He's been living away from the family in a caravan on Canvey Island. And he gets this phone call one night from his brother instructing him that he has to go to Canvey to clear out his uncle's belongings. And the brother is kind of sniffing around for money and is wanting him to find and unearth that sort of thing. Whereas John Michael's the kind of protagonist. He's at a loss and he's kind of lost at sea within himself, with his life. His marriage has dissolved. He's been sacked from his job in London. He's an editor. And he's in this kind of quagmire of alcohol and self-pity. And he's searching for some kind of foothold in the void, and he feels that going to Canvey he may find this kind of foothold with his uncle's legacy. It doesn't quite turn out that way. He gets caught up in a whole manner of kind of seedy things. He gets caught up firstly with the ebb and flow of the estuary, this kind of monotonous kind of backwards and forwards motion that's kind of hypnotic to him. And he gets kind of caught up in the big skies in the estuary, especially at night. He becomes obsessed with the stars and the constellations, as has his uncle. He finds a telescope in the shed by the caravan, which he's been observing the cosmos. And he gets involved in that. But he also gets involved in these kind of petty dramas that are unfolding on Canvey with some of the locals. But he also gets sucked into, much like the sea gets sucked out of the estuary, into Southend, which is a much more vibrant kind of place than Canvey, and he gets caught up in a kind of in the underworld there, because one day he goes to Southend Pier and finds himself talking to a girl at the end of the pier, and she kind of looks or sounds like she's in trouble, and the conversation is very brief. She says, "I've got to go, they may be watching us," and he's not really sure about what's happening until she's left and he sees her running down the pier. And the rest of the novel is him trying to find her, thinking he's found her, but he's not. They're people who look like her. They're kind of apparitions of the event that was once her, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And this kind of ties in with his uncle Ray, who, when he's searching through the caravan, he finds lots of tapes. And their recordings, monologues of his uncle describing this book he's been trying to write called Vulgar Things, which is all about trying to find truth and authenticity in the world and not being able to replicate truth and authenticity in the written word. And it's this kind of real kind of frustration in not being able to mediate the truth. with what we've got, which is just language. You know?
And that right there is, I'd suggest, the theme of the book, your version of Vulgar Things itself.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for me, Vulgar Things is an experiment in the kind of the lie of fiction, which is that it brings us closer to the truth. Whereas I would always argue that fiction is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's pure construct. It's pure. It's it's a machination of things put together in order to work or not work. You know what I mean? And that's what I'm interested in. So for me, Vulgar Things is a kind of exploration of our failure in that sense to kind of navigate the truth. You know, and it goes all the way back to Virgil and Petrarch, mm-hmm. who their work was all about the truth, but it wasn't. They were all thinly guised copies of other things. You know?
And we'll come back to both of those a little later on, but let's talk about the characters, the main characters a little bit. First of all, John is he's the narrator of the story. He's
sure.
the person who we see it through.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I'd say there were three main characters. There's John, there's Ray, who's dead.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's Laura, the girl, who's, well, an enigma. I mean, basically, I didn't know how to what extent we'll be able to talk about this, really, but you've already sort of given it away. basically, is really a figment of John's imagination.
Yeah. Do you want me to start with Laura first?
Yeah, go on then.
Laura's a kind of cipher, a kind of cog in the wheel, many wheels, of what John is essentially caught in, which is the kind of commodity of the male gaze,
mm-hmm.
which you see acted out particularly in seaside towns, which are this kind of vulgar capitalist mechanism that facilitates the male gaze, you know, the strip clubs, mm-hmm. the seedy nightclubs, the seedy arcade. It's all about, you know, the way we objectify women, you know. Mm-hmm. And so he's kind of caught in that unbeknownst, and not because he's misogynist in any way, it's just because he's the environment he stumbles into, that's its scaffold.
And in fact, he would describe himself, no doubt, as romantic. He sees Laura, who ostensibly is, you know, some form of sex worker or whatever, works in one of those clubs, decides he needs to rescue her.
Yeah, yeah, basically. And it's that real kind of sad, romantic, cliched desire which men find themselves in, not through any fault of their own other than that it's always been like that. There's a certain kind of pattern to male desire.
And she doesn't really have any say in it.
No, and she is basically the machine, you know, the money-making machine, and he's this kind of entity that tries to... He's not trying to dismantle the machine, he's just trying to save some beauty from it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's objectifying her, but he sees it as the noble thing to do. He doesn't see anything further from that. You know, he thinks that this is his quest to save this person. He doesn't realise that it's pure kind of objectification in that way, and pure kind of, you know, sexism within the male gaze swirling around, and he's just trying to hold on to something that gives him meaning.
And again, I mean, there are other people in this book who are possibly objectifying her in, you know, in different and more sinister ways, certainly. But again, the theme seems to be that she doesn't have any agency here. I mean, it's John is basically putting his idea of, you know, rescuing this woman, projecting that onto her.
Yeah.
And again, I think, as you've sort of already mentioned, and I'm making it a bit clearer perhaps, that, you know, we see this character, Laura, four or five times. He encounters her throughout the book, and we're never sure it's the same person.
No, to my mind, it isn't,
mm-hmm.
because it's not the person that matters. It's mm-hmm. the image being mediated and replicated. What matters is the event on the pier where he does meet somebody, and then everything else that happens afterwards is either an apparition of that person or a different mediation of that person. But what's steadfast, and the only thing that's steadfast, is John's desire to save this person, or this idealization of beauty as he sees it.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't really matter if it's not the same person.
Mm-hmm.
To him, it is. So I leave that kind of ambiguous, and to me, it doesn't matter if it is or isn't. And I like playing with that in the book. I like pulling the rug from under him and from under myself when I was writing it. I didn't plan there to be different. That just seemed to happen.
So tell us about John then. So where has he come from? You briefly mentioned that he's basically been thrown out of his life in London.
Yeah,
John, what's happened to him?
John, as I see it, I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of characterisation in novels, and I try to steer clear of characterisation in that sense, and I don't actually like talking about people in my novels as characters. Who you hear a lot of novelists who go, yes, and you know, he just did what he wanted, you know. And no, I'm not that sort of writer. I don't. They're pure constructs and they're pure ciphers that enable me to get from point A to B when I'm writing. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, I was going to say that does come across in the writing. It's all incredibly immediate. It's, you know, it's right in the now, and he is really a cipher. I mean, we don't learn very much about John.
No.
We do see everything through his eyes. Yeah. So he is our tool to see into the world.
Yeah, completely. And that's why it's in present tense, because I don't want him reflecting on who he is or what's happening. So he's completely, he's like a pinball in a machine being pinged to wherever without any kind of thought or as to why this is happening. He's just being pushed that way.
But he does come from somewhere, and I think that what his job is basically is relevant
mind,
to
yeah,
the way
in
he
my,
behaves. But
I think so, yeah. In my mind, he comes from the kind of archetypal Islington bourgeois media kind of environment that he is obviously not comfortable in, and he obviously doesn't fit within it. And then also within my mind, and a reviewer picked up on it recently, it's also I'm taking the bourgeois London protagonist out of that very kind of bourgeois environment. I never forget that the novel is a bourgeois construct, you know, it grew to reflect bourgeois tastes and the bourgeoisie's tastes, you know. So, you know, I kind of wanted to take a protagonist out of the kind of default mode environment for modern fiction, London, media savvy, blah, 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 and throw him kind of into the wilderness. And Canvey Island is wild in that sense, you know. And I liked that. That's why there's a kind of hoodwinking for the first kind of 20 pages or so of you think it's going to be this kind of novel about the, you know, publishing in London and blah, 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 and but it isn't. It soon is taken away from that. So, yeah, so he's a bit of driftwood in a sense. He's the square peg that doesn't fit in the round hole. He's the guy who constantly fails and doesn't know what to do about it. He's the guy who knows that there's a past, knows that there's a future, but is completely stuck in the present and can only see things through the present. And it's through him we see the past or what the future could be. And he's like this kind of node that's recording everything for the reader or for me in the way that he does. He's always recording things with his phone. And it's all about those lenses. He's a kind of lensed to this kind of strange world he's found himself in.
I'm Charlotte Higgins, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
And then we have Ray, who has spent the past however many decades on living alone on Canvey Island, basically doing the same thing, writing and then video recording everything, basically.
Yeah.
His whole life is lived through sitting and writing journals and recording every moment.
Yeah. Ray, to me, is this beautiful kind of ghost. And in a sense, we are all ghosts, especially now in this, because I'm very interested in new aesthetic and the kind of overlapping of the digitized world over what we call the real world and the digitized world becoming the real world, you know. So, and in a sense, you know, we've all got a bit of Ray in us. We all record things knowing that they will be viewed by other people. And that's why we're doing it. And there was once a time when at a rock concert, you would light a flame that can burn you, you know, that you can feel, and you would collectively put it over your head. So now you go to a concert and it's the smartphone recording the event for another time.
Yeah, which will never happen.
Exactly.
You will never watch that concert on that tiny little screen, very blurred from that distance.
Yeah, exactly. But then if it is mediated, when it is watched, it is then real, but it's a different type of reality.
But it's almost like the experience has to be experienced in the moment through a screen.
Exactly. There was a wonderful image I saw during a very horrific kind of catastrophe, which was the Twin Towers collapsing. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy, there was the TV camera, and then in front of the TV camera, there was a guy with a mobile phone filming the big screens in Times Square, relaying what was happening in Manhattan. And it was this lens upon lens upon lens, the mise-en-abîme, mm-hmm. you know, the and I just thought, that is reality. That's mm-hmm. where we're at. The event is not ever experienced. The event is always mediated.
You could sort of make an argument for doing it in that case as being some form of coping mechanism with this terrible reality that's happening in front of you.
Yeah.
But that's obviously not the same when you've been paid to go to a gig.
Yeah, yeah, I know. There's something happening with human consciousness where we are overlapping reality with a digitized unreality that mm-hmm. becomes reality. I know this is nothing new. I'm not hit something new, Baudrillard and people like that. You know, the simulacrum becomes mm-hmm. real. This is nothing new, but this has been happening and is happening. And, you know, every technology creates its new, you know, its own mediation. Every disaster creates its own mediation. You know, with the Titanic, it was the Marconi radio and things like that. Mm-hmm. With the Gulf War, it was TV.
CNN.
Yeah, CNN. And with modern day catastrophes, it's Twitter, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, so every, you know, technology kind of recreates mediation in that way, and I'm interested in that. But I'm also interested in how he records John, how he records his footsteps throughout the novel. He records certain things that he feels are real to him, so he has to record them in order to them to really be real, so he can rewatch that reality.
Well, you've got, I've just said about this idea of the video in 9/11 as a sort of coping mechanism.
Yeah.
John is the person in the present day, the modern person with the smartphone.
Yeah.
But there's an element of the fact that Ray is, and again, we won't talk about why, because, you know, that's part of the fun of the book, but it's almost as if Ray is doing this stuff as a means of coping with something that he's done.
Trauma. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's, in all the literature I love, i.e. modernism, it's the ripple of the trauma ripples through it. And it's trauma that causes the art to appear. And the traumatic event for Ray is what happens with John's mother. And that's traumatised him throughout his life, and he's trying to navigate through that in order to find that kernel of truth within it somewhere. Mm-hmm. Much like Beckett's Crap does with mm-hmm. the spools. And beneath all, and as Beckett told us, beneath all this technology, and indeed beneath everything, is desire. And that's all that can be found. In the same way that Crap's last tape, there's that moment where there, you know, where he's with his lover, and that's the moment, that's the event, mm-hmm. desire, with Ray. But he doesn't quite come to terms with it. He's unearthing, he's scraping through this trauma by recording his thoughts and recording his failed attempts to write this truthful book about her.
Mm-hmm.
And he's getting deeper and deeper and deeper down to the base root, which is his own desire, his own desires, which underpins everything.
You've mentioned the influence of Virgil on Ray and the writing of the book that he's doing. The other thing this sort of reminded me of is, in some ways, it's a tragedy in that there's an element that, in the present day, John, while he's trying to uncover what Ray has done, predestined to reenact the same things.
There's a kind of doubling in that sense, which is a kind of irony, and hopefully a kind of comedic irony. I was reading that Simon Critchley recently, and he said true tragedy is comedic,
mm-hmm.
because tragedy in the original sense, we learn something through death, through tragedy, whereas comedy, you learn nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? You repeat the same mistakes, which is why Beckett's so good,
mm-hmm.
because his tragedy is the comedy. You know, in Waiting for Godot, which is essentially about the Holocaust, and that there's that famous line in it, how many died while we were sleeping? The audiences miss that because there's a gag right before it and a gag right after it, and it's always ignored because people laugh over it, and it's the line in mm-hmm. the play. So there's, I kind of, without writing a funny book, I wanted there to be an element, a comedic element of, he's just retreading the same footsteps there. He's learning nothing from this quest. Do you know what I mean? Ha-ha! You're not going to learn anything about death. You're not going to learn anything about your life. You're just going to repeat the same things,
mm-hmm.
you know, over and over again. And that's kind of what was in my mind as I was kind of devising it. The Virgil thing is this idea of the lie about truth. You know, the Virgil's Aeneid. It's Aeneid's the true. He's forging the true history of Rome, you know, and how this happened. But he's not really. Virgil is just trying to appease his friend Augustus, mm-hmm. you know, and Virgil is just really rewriting Homer.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing truthful in that epic, you know, as beautifully brilliant and dripping with genius as it is. there's nothing truthful in it. And to me, that amuses me. A book so involved with truth is untruthful. And for me, that's the great secret lie of all art, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of writers who believe that, you know, the as Tom McCarthy would say, and Simon Critchley, art's dirty secret is inauthenticity all the way down. From the very early cave paintings of the replication of the one icon, mm-hmm. to the Byzantine paintings of the copy of the copy of the copy of the copy of the copy. You know, that's art. That's mm-hmm. where art stems from, that inauthenticity. So I want that in Vulgar Things. And in that sense, as mad and as crazed as Uncle Ray is, to us bourgeois readers, he's the only truthful character in it. Do you know what I mean? As mad as he is. And he's just really replicating Virgil, and also Petrarch as well, which is...
You know, we're going to bring it on to Petrarch next, because, well, we talked about this idea of John basically imagining the character of Laura via the medium of completely different women every time he experiences them. This is basically, you can tell us that this comes from Petrarch.
Yeah, Petrarch. Not many people read Petrarch, to my knowledge. Petrarch basically single-handedly invented the sonnet, as we know it. One day, he's walking, a real-life event, takes one of his daily walks. He meets Laura, a local girl, on the bridge. They have the briefest of chats, very mundane chat, probably just a pleasantry, hello, goodbye sort of thing, how are you? And for the rest of her life, she dies before him, and the rest of his life, he dedicates his entire work to. He writes over 800 what are now called sonnets dedicated and about Laura. Not only does he create the art of the sonnet, in that sense, which is wonderful, but he also, for me, galvanises the male desire in the artistic process for the first time. And Laura becomes the kind of the image to worship from afar. Mm-hmm. The idea of the woman on the pedestal to gaze at, to look at, to admire. Now, you know, a few hundred years later, the same thing's happening, but in a far more vulgar way. Mm-hmm. You're gazing up at the woman on the stage stripping on the pole. Do you know what I mean? And there's a real kind of connection with, you know, and all things, so many things have happened, primarily capitalism and commodity.
But of course, even back with the original version with Petrarch, Laura is, she's not a real character. She has no say in this.
No, nothing, of course. And to all accounts, I think, was completely unaware, you know, of his artistic kind of desire in that sense.
His artistic stalking.
Yeah, and he is basically a stalker in that sense, like John is a stalker. But yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. Within the male gaze, there's no, ironically, room for the woman. Do you know what I mean? It's 100% a male gaze, you know, there's nothing. And right from those sonnets, right from that day on the bridge, you know, it's, and that's what I try to replicate in Vulgar Things with the meeting on the pier. It's his interpretation of events, and that's all that matters. Not the truth, not what is actually really happening to the woman or has happened to the woman he meets on the pier.
I'm Tom Barbash, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I want to talk about perhaps another way in which you play with that idea of literature as an idea of a untruth. All the way through the book, there are other allusions to literature. We're going to talk more about the location in the second part of the show, but to sort of get us there, a large part of this book takes place in a real pub, the Lobster Smack, on Canby Island.
Yeah.
But this is a pub that Dickens wrote about. So that in itself was a deliberate move, wasn't it?
Yeah, and also a lesser-known Victorian author called Robert Buchanan, who's also a character.
He's the landlord.
Yeah, he's the landlord. And Robert Buchanan wrote Andromeda, The Idyll of the Island, a 19th century novel that is brilliant and awful at the same time. I loved it. It's but wonderful writing about Canby, but also the same myth that I recreate in the book of The Lady in the Lake, which is a common kind of myth in Canby. So yeah, I purposely place my book in a place where other books have placed their fictions. And not in a ontological sense or a Derridean sense in that way, but more to just lay things open, more to kind of to show the untruthfulness of the world of fiction, you know, to show that I'm not being authentic, to show that I'm not being original. Mm-hmm. You know, that's important to me. So, yeah, and also to nod and a wink that, you know, it's a book. It's not real life, okay? Other books have written about the same places, in the exact same place. So, in a sense, I want the ghosts of those books there, and it doesn't matter if they're not there. Some readers may not give two hoots if Dickens or Buchanan wrote about the lobster smack, you know. So it doesn't matter.
And finally, to get us to the place that we're going to talk about in the second part, this book is set in a place, in a county, that perhaps more than anywhere else in England particularly, people who don't know it have a idea of it.
Sure. A mediated idea via tabloid media and via sniffy kind of tabloid patronising media. Yeah, I mean, that's what fascinates me about this place. I love it here. My wife's from here. She was born in Thorpe Bay and grew up there. But before I met my wife, I was living in London. And yeah, my idea of Essex was the, you know, the usual cliched ideas of and images of Essex we're bombarded with. And when I came here, I immediately was struck by it. I was struck by the place and by its kind of strange beauty. Mm-hmm. You can't help but be struck by how beautiful the estuary is. And people go, but there's the big power station there. And I go, yeah, but that's part of it. You know, and like, look at all the mud. Yeah, that's beauty. It's part of it. It's a blank, beautiful canvas. You know, it's so flat and amazing. And that struck me when I first got the train here and we came out of Benfleet Station. And I was just like, wow. Yeah, wow. Gosh, cockle sheds. Wow. I didn't realise there was this kind of old Essex still in existence around here. So I immediately, and like anywhere, and like it's natural for me to immerse myself in a place. And it struck me very quickly that there's a real kind of sense of mythology in this area. There's a real sense of storytelling. And it's all to do with the land, and it's all to do with the flatness of the land and the ebb and flow of the estuary. And there's also a kind of distrust of London that I didn't think existed. You know, when you talk to you go in the old pubs in Southend, they don't much like London, some of the older guys, you know, and a lot of them, their families are from London, they're old East End types. And then there's that kind of distrust. But then there's also the kind of real vulgar bling love of London. And it's twofold. There's the real kind of horrible, glitzy Leon C bit where it's all about sitting outside the cafes with your car parked outside your big push, you know, and showing your wealth. There's that fascination with London, where they try to recreate London, or their idea of what living in London is. And then you also get the other kind of recreating of London, which is the kind of the old East End, and the kind of harking back to how it used to be in the old East End, and like, you know, the obsession with the craze and things like that. That's still in evidence here, and you know, and that fascinates me. So there's this kind of twofold obsession with London, but also a kind of deep distrust of London that really fascinates me. But then also the mythologies, the kind of beauty of the place, the secret. This is full of secrets. It's all old secret roads. Like the road just down here is called Old Southend Road, and that was the old dirt track from Prittlewell, because Southend was the south end of Prittlewell, and that was the dirt road down to the beach for the fishermen and things. So there's all these little traces. Toledo Road, just down the road from here, where a large section of vulgar things takes place, was once a river. There's always another side to the story in Southend that I like. And also, it lays itself bare, Southend. It's not ashamed of itself, which I like. You kind of take it how it is. And if you don't like it, so what? And I like that attitude. And I'm from Manchester. And it reminds me of the Manchester I grew up in, which is very working class in a city, Manchester, and the Mancunian kind of attitude of like, yeah, we're not London, who gives a shit, you know, we don't care, we're Mancunian. You get that here, you know, you get that with the Essex, you know, yeah, and they're deeply proud of being from Essex, deeply proud of being from Southend, you know. So, yeah, I completely fell in love with the place.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Lee Rourke, and we're talking about his book Vulgar Things. And on last week's show, Lee, I was talking to the author Ben Ferguson, and we were talking about Berlin.
Okay.
And we had quite a long discussion about the fact that he'd lived in Berlin and how important was that to his realisation of the city, albeit a historical novel. And, well, this is a book that's entirely saturated in its area. It seems unthinkable that it could have been written by somebody who didn't live here.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's often quite vague and dreamlike.
Yeah.
And perhaps I'm projecting that because I do live here.
Yeah.
I am now a local, and it's an amazing thing. I mean, I lived in London for a long time, wherein all media is made in London, and every street you walk down, either you've seen it before in a film, or there is a film crew making a TV programme on the corner or something.
Yeah.
You get very used to that. But to see that same thing replicated somewhere where you don't expect it is quite an unusual thing. But of course, that means nothing to somebody who doesn't live here.
No.
And I think to people that don't come from this area, they would read this and it would be like a sort of dreamlike, sort of magical realist type sort of thing.
Mm.
But to me, it's a realist novel.
Yeah, yeah. I like playing with... I don't consider myself a realist. I do it all off memory. I don't sit there with a map. And I like there being blank spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I like there being dead ends and things not quite adding up or matching up as they are in reality. So I don't try to replicate it in any way, shape or form to mirror everything around us. But I am interested in topographical properties of the area and the grid-like mapping of an area. So I plan movement of characters and where they will go. For Canvey, my research, the map I used was the lead singer of Dr. Feelgood, Lee Brillo, drew a pirate map of Canvey, and that's the map I used. So I used the reimagining of Canvey for my own reimagining of Canvey. And with the South End sections of the novel, I live in the centre of South End, so I know South End and I know the roads around. When I picture what's happening in the book, I picture the streets around me, so I just use them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the dreamlike quality of that comes from it being a reimagining rather than a mirror image. And I'm aware of that. And I enjoy it when someone from Southend or Canvey says, oh, it's so great to just, like, you know, read a fiction where the pubs I go to and things like that are in it and things like that. And I like that. But I also like it where someone from the US reads it and goes, what is this place, Canvey? What's it like? You know, and they're intrigued about it in different ways, you know, and to them it's very mysterious. I like playing with those two elements. I'm not in any sense a realist writer. I don't try to replicate the real whatsoever. Unfortunately, all I have is my perception of the real to deal with. So that's why certain real things saturate the novel. And real people. There's lots of real people in the novel. And I'm pretty sure if people in the bars of Southend and the bars that are in this novel will see themselves in it. You know, the barmaids are the barmaids. You'll go to the pub now and I think they still work there. So that's just how I kind of navigate the fiction through the real, but I'm not trying to replicate it in any way.
Well, I was going to say that the obvious realist thing to me is that you do use real places, real street names, but also real pubs. And you talk about pubs that I've been in and drank in featuring the book. And if you're a drinker or read this book and want to visit the Lobster Smack or the Crooked Billet or something, then you paint nice pictures of those.
Yeah.
You also talk about places that people won't want to visit and name them.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that work? Do you tell them? Do you have some sort of responsibility as a writer to...
No, I mean, probably I'm going to get, no one's knocked on my door yet or anything.
No, but, I imagine the landlord of the cornucopia or wherever when somebody puts this book in front of him
betrayal. I'll state that here, the cornucopia is a dreadful, horrible book. You know, it really is. It's a beautiful building and it's, it's just dreadful.
It's one of those pubs that you look at from the outside and think, that looks like it could be an amazing place.
It could just be a great pub and it's not. It's horrid. It's really horrid. And I don't care who knows that. It is a horrid pub. I wouldn't advise anyone to go there. But, that's real. If that's a reality, that's a reality. But I think it echoes the way things are laid bare in this town. Do you know what I mean? It's that's just the way it is down on the seafront. I don't think it'll last. I think things are changing. Mm-hmm. There's pockets of gentrification happening all over, and Southend is changing. And I am pretty sure that those places will eventually go, and new landlords with different ideas will take over, which is great.
But at the same time, won't... Because I actually think that seafront stretch that we're talking about now seems resistant to... But the area around it is gentrified. All the lovely fountains get put in and it becomes a bit pedestrianised up and all nice. But the places,
there's
places
a number of pubs,
same.
Isn't there? There's the Foresters, which is just horrid.
The Foresters is particularly interesting because it's ostensibly... It has a little garden. It's ostensibly a family pub with strippers.
It says family's welcome. But what I love about it as well, it's almost like a fortress.
Mm-hmm.
It's like walled. And they've got that big gate, so they've shut themselves off.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? And they're steadfastly resolute in keeping it the way it is. And it's just awful. It's the worst kind of dregs, of sad men and their desires, their real petty desires and their petty titillations. Do you know what I mean? It's really sad. I used to live in Brighton, a good 15 years ago, before it's what it is now, which is a completely gentrified kind of place. And so Brighton had those along the seafronts, and it had those seedy little places. They've all pretty much gone now, and I'm pretty sure that'll happen in Southend. It'll be sad, but it'll be a welcome relief as well for a lot of people. But I needed those places in Vulgar Things.
Mm-hmm.
I needed John to stumble into those places and be the square peg, not fit and then be spat out of them and stumble into another, because they kind of govern the world he's stumbling around, if you know what I mean. They're the kind of the stanchions of that crude kind of commodity down there, and they're the pillar stones of that crude community. So he had to visit those places and they had to be as they are. and as real as they are.
Mm-hmm. I want to sort of go back to that idea of the pirate map and how that the sort of imagined version sort of lays on on top of the realist one. I think, you know, for me it was almost most apparent in, you know, John, he travels back and forth between almost with the sort of coming and going of the tides from Canvey into Southend, back to Canvey. And often he'll walk from Canvey to... nobody would do.
No.
Right. So I think in some respects that geography it seems to be truncated.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I've cycled from Southend onto Canvey along that kind of seawall bit that you can see off the train. And I wouldn't like to walk it because it takes most of the morning. But yeah, he just pleasantly does it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he walks into Southend and walks back to Canvey. But I like that kind of... I like those black holes, those blank spaces. I see, you know, in the same way that when you're watching EastEnders and they're in the Queen Vic, you know that behind you, there's no Queen Vic. You know that above you, there's no Queen Vic. You just see what you need to see. If the shot's being made there, then everything in front of that shot within frame needs to be right. It doesn't matter if there's a blank space between, you know. So that's how I kind of see fiction. It doesn't matter that in reality it takes far longer to walk from Canvey in a fiction, in my novel. It doesn't, you know, and it's not going to change the world. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it doesn't, so it's, and it's easier for me. It's construct. So it's easier for me to... I want him to walk because it's about walking. Mm-hmm. And I want him to walk from Canvey to Southend. And in my novel, he can do that.
I'm Gaia Vince, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I sort of mentioned this idea of him following the sort of ebb and flow of the tide. Yeah. So perhaps I'd like to elaborate on that, how the landscape, the sort of the flat, the estuary, the mud, affects the characters in this book.
I think it completely affects John, and it also affects my writing of John. The blackness, for a start, when you're out there and it's night and the sky, I mean, is so kind of foreboding and really kind of puts you under the microscope. Do you know, and really makes you think, my God, look at me, how insignificant and little I am. You know what I mean? And then, and you know, and this is nothing new. You know, if you, the first paragraph of Heart of Darkness, Conrad, he talks about the grey sky and the grey sea welding together into a vanishing flatness. And it's that same kind of psychological effect it has. This, sometimes when you look out into that estuary, it becomes a huge nothingness. And sometimes when you go out to the end of the pier, A, there's nothing at the end of the pier. And B, you're kind of being delivered by in this like really tacky train to nothingness. And especially when the tide's just out and it's reflecting the sky and you're just out on the end of this pier and it's like you're surrounded by nothingness. And for me, when you are confronted with nothingness, that's where the petty dramas can begin. And again, with the mud, I see it as a very big, flat, blank canvas where you can do what you want with it and then it's washed away. And then you can redo what you want with it and then it's washed away. And at the very start of the book, he speaks to a barmaid in a pub in Soho and they talk about, oh, is this just another petty drama? And that's kind of what the book is about, you know, this kind of, remember the Exa sketch kind of toys from the 70s? And you could create a mess. You know, you could try to draw a car and you never could. Then you get frustrated and it would become a mess. And then you could just brush it away and it'd all be pristine again. And it's kind of what happens here with the, in my mind, with the ebb and flow of the estuary. These petty dramas are acted out. Everything becomes a mess and unfolds and lays itself bare. Then the sea comes in and takes it all away again. You know, and that's kind of what's happening. And that's why there's no real denouement. There's no kind of real thrust. They're just these little things that happen. And they're not Joycean epiphanies or anything like that. They're kind of more anti-epiphanies, you know. They're little things, signposts that happen throughout the novel. He may record them or try and find some sense within them, but they're nothing much and they certainly won't be there tomorrow. So the landscape, in my imagination or imagining of it, it's all about that. It's all about the toing and froing, the cleansing, the kind of flatness. the welding together of nothingness upon nothingness, you know, and what that can open up within you.
We're both people that have come to Southend via London, ostensibly from the north. You're originally from Manchester.
Yeah.
I was born in the Midlands, but my family are from the northeast.
Okay.
How do you... You sort of hinted at this in the first half, but how do you compare the southeast and its sort of attitude to life and, you know, the welcomeness of the people, perhaps, to what you're used to from your background in the northwest?
There's a lot... I find a lot of similarities. I find a lot of similarities, especially now. I don't know if this is happening everywhere, but there's a real kind of showy, brassy kind of way about people down here.
Mm-hmm.
They like to, if they, you know, if they made a bit of money, they like to show it. Well, when I grew up in Manchester, if you made a bit of money, you didn't like to show it because not a lot of people would like you if you had a lot of money. But now, when I go back, there's real displays of wealth, especially in the area where I grew up, that they didn't used to be. And I don't know if that's kind of part of a kind of vulgar modernity we've been thrust into, or if it's a kind of, oh, we're one and the same. But aside from that, there's a real sense of, as I said, of community, of family, of storytelling. There's also that real kind of sad men's culture acted out in the pubs, which is very old-fashioned. You know, in the when I used to go to the old pubs in Manchester that still exist today, you know, that working-class pubs in Southend are very same. I'm sure they are all around the country, but that indoors kind of attitude and those tall tales being told. And then, you know, so there's all... I see those sort of similarities. I find it very friendly down here, which, you know, you're led to believe as a northerner that the southerners aren't friendly.
Do you find that in comparison to London, though? Because I found moving out here to be a lot friendlier than living in London. But then I was only earlier this year up in Manchester for a few days and was immediately taken back about how friendlier everybody was down here.
Manchester's very friendly. Well, growing up in Manchester, if you heard a different accent, you would... you'd be fascinated. I was. Where are you from? Oh, right. What are you doing here? Oh, really? You know, and there's a real kind of... London, you know, is so big and everyone's from everywhere. It doesn't really matter if you hear a different accent. And everyone's trying to get somewhere because it's really hard to get from A to B. It's what you don't understand when you're in Manchester and you go down to London. You don't understand how big London is. And you don't understand how hard it is from get to A to B in London if you're going to meet someone. So that's why everyone's caught up in their own little solipsistic world. They're trying to get somewhere. So you kind of mistake that for unfriendliness. But, you know, if you drink in the pubs in London, you know, they're friendly people, really. But down here, there's a kind of, you know, people will talk to you, you know, and people have time to talk because we're not rushing about to get places. But saying that, New York's a friendly town. I mean, I was always struck by how friendly people are there, and that, you know, that's a real hustle bustle kind of place. So I think there's similarities. I've written an essay, or I'm just about to finish an essay for Influx Press about my experiences of moving down from London to Southend, and I do mention the differences with London, but also the similarities. Moving to Southend has made me think about Manchester more than I did when I was in London. You know, oh, yeah, that's very similar, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, so if you get past media mythology of the area, if you get past the fact that it's not London, it never will be London, do you know what I mean? You know how much parts of this area try to be, it never will be. If you get past that, you get past, you know, the fact that, you know, there's certain things that you won't find here that were on your doorstep in London, then it's just a great place. You know, it's a great place to live. And, well, I've been here 3 years now and absolutely love it. I can't see myself really moving away from this area.
I've been here 7 years and really love the place, and we have a lot of friends now and really feel part of the community. A place that when I... not particularly often go to, but actually was there just last weekend, funnily enough, that feels completely different to this place. Of course, it's the place that we're talking here about Southend, but the place that features heavily in this book is Canvey Island. Yeah. Let's talk about Canvey Island for a bit. What is it about Canvey?
Canvey, gosh, where do I start? Canvey is just fascinating. A, it's below sea level. You know, it's reclaimed land. The Dutch came over here and they're still old Dutch roundhouses on Canvey, who were, they were experts in, mm-hmm. in reclaiming the marshland. So if you look at, if you're at the sea wall at Canvey, you see the sea, and then you look down, and there's street level. That really hits home when you get there. When I first went to Canvey, mm-hmm. it felt different. And the people who live there call themselves, you know, islanders. Mm-hmm. You know, they really feel a dislocation mm-hmm. from everywhere else. And I'm interested in that in fiction. My previous novel, The Canal, was about dislocation from reality. The canal is lower down than street level in London. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in that. So I was immediately struck by that. And then I was also struck by the history of Canvey. There's been a real... There was the catastrophe of the flood mm-hmm. that killed all those people. And I had family on my wife's side who helped in the rescue, who were on Canvey when it happened. That evening, my wife's grandfather was a farmer. He used to take his cattle onto Canvey mm-hmm. and he was there that night of the flood. So there's that. I always knew about Canvey. Growing up in Manchester, I'd heard of Canvey mm-hmm. and thought it was this really kind of idyllic place people went on holiday.
Which it is.
People do go on holiday there. You know, people go on caravanning holidays there. And then, so there's that. And then there's the whole Dr. Feelgood thing mm-hmm. and that kind of mythology of the Thames Delta. That kind of sprang from there. But then there's also this kind of... It's a strange place. And it's densely populated now, but it didn't used to be. And people used to... Like, families used to live in old abandoned railway carriages mm-hmm. and things like that. And because, like, it's reclaimed land, all the electricity wires are like telephone wires. You know, the electricity is on poles mm-hmm. along the streets. And it kind of has that Wild West... Mm. feeling about it, and it was the last place in the UK to have CCTV. So football hooligans would meet on Canvey to fight so that they wouldn't get caught. You know, so it has all this kind of outsider kind of mentality to it, and I'm pretty sure that the people who live on Canvey, that's natural to them. But there's also kind of micro lives being lived there. There's the kind of the Cockneys done good mm-hmm. would buy plots of land there and build their houses. And there's a kind of real... There's a, like a millionaire's row on Canvey with these neo-Grecian kind of, you know...
Footballers' mansions.
Yeah. They look really... They're eyesores, but they're mansions, but they look dreadful. And, you know, so all this is being acted out. And it's a very... No, it's not a big island. It's just this densely populated, strange place. And then... When you get to the jetty area of Canvey and where the lobster smack is, you find this beautiful-looking weatherboard pub mm-hmm. that anywhere else in England would have this beautiful view of the sea, you know, would overlook this beautiful... But because of the topography and because of the history of the island, there's just this sea wall that obliterates any kind of view of the estuary. And I just love that. And I wanted that to be replicated in Vulgar Things, because when Dickens wrote about it and Buchanan wrote about it, it was just basically on the waterfront, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. you could see Kent. But now there's this concrete wall that just obliterates any idea of the idyll, you know, and I love that about, and that to me kind of perfectly sums up what's strange and beautiful about Canvey. And I also... You know, it has its mythologies. There's lots of stories. The Lady in the Lake is the big one. But there's lots of strange stories about Canvey. But what interests me the most is the way people in Southend and Leigh-on-Sea and Westcliff literally and metaphorically look down on Canvey. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And you get the, oh, it's all a bit Canvey. You know what I mean? If something's not very to their taste. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? And that fascinates me because I hate that attitude. But that also ties in with, you know, in Vulgar Things, the kind of pedestals and the, mm-hmm. and looking down and looking up and all that kind of thing. And so, yeah, I mean, I would advise everyone to go to Canvey and just have a look around. You can do that wonderful walk around the sea wall. You go from the Lobster Smack past the Labworth Cafe mm-hmm. round to Canvey Heights. And it's a wonderful walk. And you kind of get a sense of the area and these beautiful... huge container ships just gliding by, and you really can, I talk about it in Vulgar Things, but you really can feel the rumble mm-hmm. of the engines of these powerful things reverberating, you know. And I love, yeah. So yeah, it's a great place. I knew immediately when we first went there. We cycled onto it with my in-laws. They took us there, and I knew immediately that I would set a novel on Canvey. It just made sense to me.
I'm Ben Ferguson, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Just one final question then to finish off, and more generally, you spoke earlier about, you know, the novel itself being, you know, an artificial thing, and particularly a bourgeois construct. And we've also talked about modern technology and, you know, and its place in the modern world. And modern technology is something that's nowadays has affected massively the novel, not just the novel, but the novelists, like the world of literature. So being a young modern novelist nowadays, how do you see yourself as a novelist? What's your role?
That's a very good question. I don't know if there is a role for the novelist like there used to be anymore. I mean, you do get your public intellectuals, some of them who are novelists that people turn to and want them to comment on world events. But there doesn't seem to be the need for novelists in the same way. There's the need for books to be read. There's lots of books being written. There's lots of books being read. But novelists don't really matter like they used to. I don't think there's a real role outside of writing the book itself. I do think of myself as a novelist or a writer, but it certainly doesn't define me, and it certainly doesn't give me agency to talk about the world on outside of literature. You know, it doesn't give me any agency in that sense as it once would have done. It certainly hasn't made me rich, which is no bad thing. I didn't get in it to be a millionaire. You know, it's the only thing I can basically do. And I love doing it, even though it's hard work and I hate sitting down to write.
But what should you be writing if it's not like that sort of important state of the nation type?
Bad novels. And I'll explain it. There's the artist and novelist, Stuart Holme, and he's a Marxist writer. And he once argued that the only way to be a true revolutionary novelist now is to write a bad novel. And he means that as a direct attack to bourgeois default mode tastes. Mm-hmm. This kind of establishment literary fiction that is a kind of lyrical humanist mirror that we hold up, and the bourgeois look into the mirror, see something of themselves, recognise something of the world around them, give themselves a nice pat on the back for doing so, and then move on. Now, the bad novel, he doesn't mean write a bad novel, but he means the bad novel disrupts that. Mm-hmm. The bad novel doesn't give pleasure to the reader. The bad novel disrupts reading pleasure, which is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I always say I don't want to give pleasure to my readers. I want to disrupt reading pleasure. I want them to find it unsettling. I don't want them to like my characters in that sense. I certainly don't want them to empathise with them. And I certainly don't want it to be a true reflection of the world around them. I want it to be a kind of, I want it to fuck with the symbolic order of things. That's what I think novelists should be doing. And I think that's the only thing novelists can do right now. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're just recreating and repeating the same default mode, which is this very nice, lyrical, neoliberal, humanist novel. And my favourite writers like Rob Grillet, you know, they said, what's the point in writing a novel when the novel does the reading for you? Do you know what I mean? What is the point in that? There should be an intersection, there should be a collision between the thing, the novel, and the person who picks it up. Mm-hmm. And it should hit them. And you should either be blown away by it, carried away, or blown away and repulsed and just, you know, think, what the hell was that? Mm-hmm. And I think if you can do that, then that's a good thing. So to me, it doesn't matter if Vulgar Things is liked or disliked. They're one and the same thing. So yeah, I think that's what novelists should be doing. And the majority of them aren't. Mm-hmm. The majority of novelists have their eye on the prize and have their eye on their readership and want their readership to like them.
Well, nonetheless, I should finish by saying that we are supposed to be recommending and flogging books here. So Vulgar Things by Lee Rook is an absolutely cracking read. It doesn't read anyway like the way that Lee has just described it, so do ignore his last few points. So yes, we've been talking about Vulgar Things by Lee Rook, which is out now from Fourth Estate. So Lee, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me
about
it.
Thank you so much, I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, or even a lot, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.